And I was a smoker in the 80s when I started anchoring. And I used to have a cigarette going during the show. It'd be sitting just off camera in an ashtray. And every once in a while, I'd hear the director would say to me through my ear, move the cigarette, the smoke's, you know, a little wafting into the shot.
Welcome to the 100th and final episode, at least for a while, of Mostly Money. I wanted to have a special guest for this send-off show, and I don't think I can top who offered to help me out. You know when people say our next guest needs no introduction? Well, that is actually true in this case. He is a Canadian icon, a broadcasting legend. When this guy walks into a room, time stops. And let me tell you, it really is an honor that the one and only Peter Mansbridge is my special guest today. With 50 years at the CBC, culminating in the top job, anchor of the national for many of those years, he's seen a lot. And I wanted to ask him a bit about what life is like inside a major network news department, but also wanted to tap into the stories behind the stories of some of the big financial events in Canada. Past elections, budgets, the story behind how the GST was introduced, and more. Without further ado, the one and only Peter Mansbridge. This is Mostly Money, and I'm your host, Preet Banerjee. And on the show today, I have the most impressive guest that has ever been on this podcast. Apologies to all previous guests who are listening, but no one can top this guy. During his 50 years at CBC, Peter Mansbridge anchored coverage of basically every single big news event you could imagine. The fall of the Berlin Wall, the 9/11 terrorist attacks, 13 Olympic Games, every visit by the Queen since 1970, three royal weddings, two royal funerals. And he's covered every federal election since 1972 and anchored all 10 since 1984, even after retirement, came back as a special contributor for the 2019 election. Now
I feel really old. I feel really old, Preet, after all that.
I don't know if you know this, but you actually are really old.
That's true.
He's conducted an estimated, this is mind-blowing, 15,000 interviews with the who's who of the world. And I'm so delighted to have him as a guest on the Mostly Money Show. Peter, welcome to the show.
Hey, Preet. Thank you for this. You know, I've been a big fan of yours for a long time. And it's nice to be on the other side of the microphone for a change.
Well, you know, it's not intimidating at all. I mean, this is my 100th episode. And as I was prepping, I'm thinking, wow, 100 episodes. Now, I'm not a prolific podcaster by any stretch of the imagination, but I was very proud of the fact that I've gotten to 100 episodes. I wanted a super special guest. I made the call to you. And then as I was doing my prep, I saw, wait a second, this guy's done 15,000 interviews. Oh, God, I feel like such a schmuck in comparison.
it's funny, you know, when you start adding them up, the total gets, I think it's upwards closer to 20,000 now, but they add up pretty quick, and over 50 years, they really add up fast. So
yeah, no kidding.
And some of them are worth remembering, most of them are not worth remembering.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting. With so many, I mean, these are all better than every interview Preet Banerjee has ever conducted.
I doubt it. I doubt it very much. I don't know about you, but what I've found in my interviewing time is that the ones you tend to remember, obviously you remember the kind of celebrity interviews, the big mm-hmm. names, you know, President Obama, presidents of various countries and prime ministers and you
There's
name it.
There's so many that you can't even
yeah,
remember.
Exactly. I mean, you remember those, but the ones that actually really make a difference, where you think you've actually learned something and your audience has learned something, are often with those who aren't the celebrity interviews, because right. for the most part, they kind of repeat the same thing to whomever is interviewing them. Whereas right. the non-celebrities are usually people who have never been interviewed before, but they're willing to tell their story, and their story is involving something, you know, extraordinary that's happened to them. And you find, I've found those people the most fascinating, really, when you get right down to it.
Well, yeah, because they don't have the handlers, right?
That's
and
right.
one of the things that I think a lot of people have noticed, especially lately, because now every interview, every question that gets asked of a politician, you can find it in 7 different social media platforms, different news websites, and you can ask them 30 different questions and you'll always get the exact same answer, even if it has nothing to do with the question.
Yep.
So, yeah, no, that's an interesting observation about the different interviewees. Now, I wanted to sort of give some background of how we met. And it was all because of the Bottom Line panel on CBC, which was a panel talking about finance and economics. And I remember I got an email out of the blue from Lara Chatterjee, who was a producer of that panel. And she invited me to be on. And when I came to the set, and the first time that I met you, and I think you came into the makeup room, that was the first time I really was like starstruck, where I was like, man, I'm starting to feel cotton in my mouth. I was getting so nervous before the lights went on. But luckily, you carried me, and they invited me back for some reason. And we ended up doing that panel for about 8 years.
Yep.
And it was the highlight of my career, because as soon as the panel aired, my inbox would get flooded. My tweet mentions would get flooded. And I'll tell you this funny story. So my first time I showed up in my suit and a tie. And then after about 2 years, I'd sent an email to Lara. I said, you know, Lara, I don't normally come across as the suit and tie guy. Like, I don't normally wear a tie every day. And I try to be more relatable to the average household and distill some of this information to eye level. And I feel that, you know, wearing a tie is off brand. You know, do you think I could maybe not wear a tie? And I was expecting just a simple yes or no. You know, whatever. And then she writes back, and I feel like I should whisper what she wrote. It was like, I think you should go for it. I'm like, wow, this makes it sound like it's a way bigger deal than I thought it was going to be. And so I show up and I don't wear a tie. And that night, so normally what happens for the listeners' understanding is we pre-tape at 7 and the panel airs at, you know, 9:30 on News Network and then on the main channel at about 10:30. About 10:35, I started getting flooded with emails, and they basically all said, listen, son, if you're going to be talking with Peter Mansbridge, you better be wearing a goddamn tie.
you were at the front line, sort of the leading edge of the change in television and in, you know, in appearances, because now it's like perfectly normal not to be wearing a tie, right?
Right, right.
And you were sort of right out there. I can remember when you walked in the studio that day without a tie the first time. I thought, geez, should I offer him one of my 250 ties in my dressing room? Because he clearly forgot his. No, we loved you on that panel because you brought a common sense to a lot of the discussions that we were having. And, it was a great... It was a great panel, and I'm sorry for the fact. I mean, the CBC obviously wanted to change after I left, and they've made a number of, you know, great decisions. But I thought one of the decisions that wasn't so great was that they dropped out of things like the Bottom Line and the Foreign Policy Panel. You know, those were great discussion points, and people did rely on them to get a better sense of the world they were living in, whether it was about the economy or foreign affairs or what have you. But you were, look, it launched your career. Look at you, Preet.
Absolutely. You know, I owe it all to you.
Best-selling author, best-selling podcast, you name it. You're all over the place.
Yeah, I know a lot of people will come on and they'll say, yeah, I'm a national bestseller. I think I can make the claim that I'm a municipal bestseller for sure. I don't know about national, but...
it's the big, yeah, as you know, the book business is funny. I mean... You try to get on the bestseller list, and that's one you know, one part of your branding. And then if you can get to number one, even for like a half a week, you're right. always a number one yeah. best-selling author.
Well, you know, speaking of books,
right?
One of the reasons that I had the idea to sort of celebrate my 100th by asking you was because I saw that you had just announced that you have a new book that is coming out and pre-sales are available now. So before we get started, maybe you could just tease the book a little bit and tell us what is in this book that is being released. I think it's in October, right?
It's in October, October 5th. It's called Off the Record. And as you know, as you would know, when you, say you're out for dinner with some friends or something, and you end up talking about a story you covered, the odds are the story you tell at that dinner is not the one you reported on the air, right? There was something else happened about that story that made it that interesting that you would actually bring it up at a dinner. Well, that's what this book is. The book is a lot of the stories behind the stories that I covered over my 50 years. The publisher, Simon & Schuster, wanted to call it a memoir, but it's not really a memoir. It's really a series of anecdotes, 50 or 60 of them, that I weave into a couple of, more substantive chapters on journalism, on the country. But mainly it's these anecdotes that give you a snapshot into what my life has been like as a journalist who's traveled around the world and obviously around the country. And some of the stories that I love to tell that I never told on the air. So that's what it's about. And I think the early indications are from those who've, done a read to, how the publisher sends these books out to get blurbs on them. You know, somebody famous writes something about the book. They're really good. People seem to enjoy it. So it'll be out October 5th. I was very lucky last year. I wrote a book with Mark Bulgich called Extraordinary Canadians, which was a look at 17 Canadians who have faced certain challenges in their lives and come out the other end really well. That book actually turned out to be a number one national bestseller. So hopefully with any luck, this one will be somewhat the same.
I have a feeling no luck will be involved whatsoever. I'm definitely going to make the pre-sales, and I'm sure you'll probably pre-sell more books than I have ever sold when my books have been on sale.
Please. Your books do extremely well, as they should.
All right. So I wanted to bring you on, and of course this podcast is called Mostly Money, which I think is apropos because it's mostly about financial stuff, but it doesn't have to be specifically about finances. But I did want to sort of talk to you about some of the big events, financial events that have happened in your career covering the biggest events in the world. And before we get started, there's two things I want to do. One is I want to share with you a comment that a listener sent in ahead of this recording because they knew that you were going to be a guest. And then second is also to talk about your origin story, which I'm sure you're sick of telling, you know, how you were discovered. So, you know, the Coles notes is fine. But I had a listener who sent in a comment. This is from listener Claire. And she said one of the great joys in her life was working alongside the great Tony Mansbridge.
Yes, Tony was great. I remember Tony. I patterned myself after Tony, watching how he did things. And yes.
So that's kind of an inside joke. That was Claire Martin, who was, a chief meteorologist or senior meteorologist at CBC for a long time. And
star of Pink Floyd's The Wall. Did you know that? Pink Floyd, The Wall, their video. She was in it.
She was in I do vaguely remember this because I know Claire personally, and someone had told me that story.
She hates it. When I used to bring it up occasionally on the air, and she would hate me for saying that. But it's true. And if she's going to call me Tony, I'm going to remind everybody about Pink Floyd.
Well, I'm going to include that clip because there is a clip of Claire – you were throwing it to Claire. And I guess as the meteorologist, she's talking to, you know, local anchors as well as the national anchor. And I think she had just been talking to Tony Parsons.
That's
and
right.
And so when you threw to Claire, she said, oh, thanks, Tony. And then I remember coming back to the studio, you held up a sign that said, it either said Peter to remind her what your actual name was or Tony.
Peter, back to you. Thanks very much, Peter. Thanks very much, Peter. Thanks very much, Tony. Beautiful day for the beautiful Tony. Game in through parts. Tony. Tony. Oh, I keep calling you the wrong name, don't
Tony.
I?
Tony.
She was mortified by that. Okay, so for people who don't know, you were discovered because of your voice. Is that correct?
Yeah. The Coles Notes version is pretty simple. I dropped out of high school. I never went to university. I ended up in, I'll keep it short. I ended up in Churchill, Manitoba, working for an airline called Transair. And I was basically a baggage handler, occasional ticket agent. And I was 19 years old. And one day they were really busy at the counter and they asked me to announce the flight over the PA system, which I did. You know, Transair, flight 106, Thompson the Pond, Winnipeg, now ready for boarding at gate one. Only had one gate, Churchill, small.
Why did they number it?
Just because it sounded really good. You know, it sounded like, hey, we're a big airline. And there was a guy in the terminal building who came over and said, hey, you've got a really good voice. Have you ever thought about being in radio? And I said, I've never thought about being in radio. He said, I'm the manager of the CBC Northern Service Station here in Churchill. I have a shift late at night. I can't get anybody to work it. Everybody I approach is not interested. Would you be interested? I said, sure. I mean, there wasn't exactly a lot to do in Churchill at night other than what you can imagine you'd do at night in Churchill. And so I worked during the day at Transair, and I worked in the evening at the CBC for about a year until they decided to offer me a full-time job, at which point I switched to news because I was terrible at me. I was a DJ that first year. But they didn't have a newscast. I said, I think we should have a newscast, and they agreed and let me start one with no training, no idea of what to do or anything. But that's what we did, and that's how it started. So it was a total fluke. But as is the case in so much of life, it's, you know, every once in a while something will come your way. It's pure luck, but it's what you do with it, how you make it work for you.
Yeah, well, you definitely took that opportunity and made the most of it. As your career, you were 50 years at CBC. You're the guy. Like, you're the guy of news when people think about, you know, anchors. When did you discover, and I'm guessing here, I'm making an assumption here, when did you discover your passion for covering politics? Because it seems like you really enjoy covering politics. When did that transition happen from, you know, hosting that radio show to then becoming a parliamentary reporter?
Right. I'd grown up in a family that we always talked politics around the dinner table. At night, we always had supper together. My dad was always home for supper. We grew up in Ottawa, and politics in the late 50s and early 60s was a pretty interesting game in Ottawa. And so we talked about it a lot. So there was always part of me that was interested. But after I left Churchill, I went to Winnipeg and then Winnipeg to Regina. This is all with the CBC in different roles. And then they offered me a job as a parliamentary correspondent in Ottawa. And I didn't really want to go because I like the wide open spaces and more general reporting than being kind of pigeonholed into one area, which was political. But within 2 weeks of being in Ottawa, I thought, my gosh, I love this. This is great. And so it's been a part of me ever since, being interested in politics. And, you know, I have a podcast now competing with yours.
You could call it a competition.
Yeah, it's a competition. and there's obviously there's a lot of politics in it, and there will be a lot more this summer and fall as we head into a likely election.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You hear a lot about supply chains these days, because if the past couple years have taught us anything, it's that an efficient, well-managed supply chain is absolutely critical to keeping businesses successful and consumers happy. I'm Will Haywood, and I host a podcast called All Business, No Boundaries, where we talk about supply chains, how they work, what happens when they don't, and the innovations that are redefining what's possible in the world of logistics. Join me for insightful interviews with thought leaders and industry experts. We discuss how optimizing supply chains can break down the barriers that are holding businesses back. That's All Business, No Boundaries by DHL Supply Chain. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, and when you started covering the political beat, eventually you worked your way to the anchor desk, and you're covering, and in fact, you were the editor in charge of the news for CBC. So when that started, when you first got the call to say, hey, do you want to anchor the National, that first time, did you have any nerves about it, or were you seasoned at this point to the point that you're like, yeah, this is a great opportunity. I'm champing at the bit to do this. What did it feel like for you? Because from the outside looking in, it feels like there's nothing like, you'd be like Teflon. Nothing would faze this guy. But what's it really like? What was it really like for you at that time?
At the beginning. Well, first of all, when I was in Churchill, I used to dream that my goal was to read the National, that I wanted to be the chief correspondent of the CBC. And I never told anybody because they would have laughed at me. But that was my goal. And I set out a pattern and a kind of agenda of different jobs that I would have to get to first before I could get to this one. So anyway, it comes along, and the first National that I did was on a Saturday night in, I think, November of 81, I think. And I was in there filling in for George McLean. It was a great voice from back then. And he was away on holidays or something. And I came in, and my heart was pounding all day at the thought of doing it. And then when I was sitting in the chair waiting for the 11 o'clock, which was what time we were on in those days, to come, I was sure that if anybody was looking at me, they could see my heart pounding through my suit jacket. So I was pretty nervous. But slowly that got away. What I've always found is there's always a bit of nerves, no matter what the broadcast is, at the very beginning. And if you get through those first 10 seconds, then, things tend to be okay. But I learned that from, I was co-anchoring sort of the color guy on the 72 election broadcast out of Winnipeg for Manitoba. So it was the federal election, but we had these local inserts. And the main anchor is a fellow by the name of Bill Guest, who was a terrific, bit of a legend icon in Manitoba broadcasting. And he was sitting there, and I was the young kid from Churchill who was sitting beside him. And, we come up to 30 seconds before air, and I was feeling pretty nervous, and I look over at Bill, and he looked great from the waist up, but his hands were under the desk, and they were just shaking, and I could see them shaking, and I looked at him, and I said, Bill, you're not nervous, are you? And he looked at me, and he said, listen, kid, the day you're not nervous before a big show like this is the day you should get out of the business. And I always remembered that. And, he was right. And bingo, you never would have known it watching him. He was like cool as ice. But it gets the energy going inside. And you recognize that what you're doing is important. So you better do it right.
Well, this is fascinating because this ties into kind of, with your book, the what happens behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And so I know that one of your favorite movies is Anchorman. during the time of the Bottom Line panel was around the time that Aaron Sorkin's show The Newsroom was on. And I want you to give your take on, and I know Anchorman is a comedy, but in terms of the things that they got right, or in the newsroom, for people who don't have a view to see what happens, you know, behind the cameras and all the people involved and the flurry of activity leading up to the show, like the stress, can you talk about what it's like in a newsroom and how accurate the newsroom was, or if there's anything that from the anchorman that people say, or you would say to people, you have no idea how bang on accurate that one thing is. You think that's a joke, but that actually happens.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that. I thought Anchorman was a very funny movie, but that's kind of the end of it.
Right.
You know, it probably relates in some area to the truth in certain, not all, but certain local stations. I mean, it's a carry-on from the old Mary Tyler Moore show where Ted Knight was a bit of a, you know, he was just a face and a voice and not too many smarts, and they made fun of him all the time. And that was the case in some local operations, especially in the States, but in some in Canada as well. Aaron Sorkin show, The Newsroom, as opposed to the old newsroom show that used to be on CBC many years ago. Aaron Sorkin show is a pretty good reflection of what happens and the tensions that exist within a major network newsroom. Because it is tense, and the responsibility and the accountability that goes with it is serious. And, you know, when things happen and big stories hit, there's a lot of activity in that newsroom and a lot of action. When something goes wrong, as in the case of the first year of the newsroom when they, you know, there was an issue surrounding the sourcing, that's a huge problem within a newsroom, and you challenge each other, and that's all part of the process of accountability. So I thought Sorkin's portrayal of what happens in a major network newsroom was pretty accurate. You know, a few things that you'd pick over, but for the most part, it was really good. And the relationships that develop in a newsroom, all of that, it was all, you know, a very accurate, in my view, portrayal of what happens.
Yeah, and of course, it's made for TV. There's some dramatic licenses that are taken. So you are suggesting that, you know, there's a scene where Will McAvoy accidentally eats some edible marijuana brownies before going on the air, and he's completely baked. So you're saying that's never happened to you?
No, that happened quite often. No, I don't recall that ever happening. But, you know, I was there long enough that smoking was, smoking ordinary cigarettes, was perfectly all right in the newsroom. And guys used to smoke cigars and pipes and all of that stuff. And I was a smoker in the 80s when I started anchoring. And I used to have a cigarette going during the show. It'd be sitting just off camera in an ashtray. And every once in a while, I'd hear the director would say to me through my ear, move the cigarette, the smoke's, you know, a little wafting into the shot. So that was a potential problem.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but wow. But no, I don't.
That's so wild to even think about today.
No, I can never... never got baked ready for a show, but maybe I should have tried that on some shows, but I never had one.
Okay, so now I want to ask you about a couple of news items that you would have covered in your career, just to get a sense, and you can go as wide and deep or not as you want on any of these issues, but when it comes to the federal budgets... there's two things I want to ask you. One is, can you explain to people what is the budget lockup procedure for journalists covering the budget, and why is that instituted in the first place?
Well, it's sort of a hangover from the past. Things have changed somewhat in today's world, but the whole idea behind a lockup was to give a chance for journalists to understand, you know, what was in this sometimes 300-400 page document, and what some of these measures actually meant. And they were locked up because they didn't want them, you know, running out and spilling the beans on the air before, especially before the markets closed at 4 o'clock. And that's why budgets are usually at right after 4 o'clock. You know, that was the main process. So it got more and more sophisticated as time went on. When I was doing budgets in the 70s, it was a pretty straightforward lockup. It would run 4 or 5 hours. There would be a couple of people in there who were available for briefings on as to what certain things meant, and the reporters would line up in there. Today, or at least the last time I was involved with one, you could go in there with your experts, with your Preet Banerjees, who would also you know, look at the documents and help you frame questions for either during the briefings that were taking place in the lockup or afterwards to the interviews with the finance minister. And so you had a pretty good idea when you came out as to, how to best describe this, you know, complicated stuff to an audience who are interested in knowing how it would impact them, but by doing so in such a way that they'd understand, which is always a challenge with budgetary items. It was bad enough that the reporters half the time didn't understand some of the stuff, but then to have them being the people who were explaining it to consumers, that was always a challenge. And some budgets are bigger than others. You know, like I remember the 80 budget with McKechnie, and Alan McKechnie was the finance minister, and it was the National Energy Program was in there. And, you know, trying to figure that one out and realizing it was going to cause a huge national unity crisis with Alberta. And then again, 2 years later after that, McKechnie brought in a budget that was dealing with a form of wage and price controls with limits on both wages and prices that were lower than the interest rate was at the time. So, I mean, it was a really challenging time to try to explain these issues and for consumers to try and figure out what the heck was going on. I mean, people are so used to low interest rates right now that they have no idea what it was like 30 years ago when interest rates. I mean, I remember getting a mortgage at 12% and thinking, I got a deal. because they were going as high as like 18, 19, 20% interest rates on mortgages, which is the big fear right now. The inflation is starting to track higher, and how high could it go, and what impact could it have? I mean, God forbid we should ever face interest rates like that before, but there's a lot of people who are right on the edge in terms of what interest rate they are paying on their mortgages. They got to be really careful.
When you talk about contentious budgets period, so, you know, in the 80s in the National Energy Program, another one that I think would have been contentious, and maybe you can give us the background of what was going on around this time, was the introduction of the GST in 1989. And so now we take it for, you know, as accepted. Yes, we have this GST that we have to pay. But when it was introduced, I think if you ask someone today, you know, like say someone under 35, and you were to ask them, who do you think introduced it? Which party do you think introduced it? And where do you think the opposition came from? I don't know if that would line up with what actually happened back then. So can you walk through the introduction of the GST?
Well, it's interesting because it kind of flew under the radar in many ways at the time. First of all, it was one of those things that nobody could understand. You know, GST replaced another tax, which was similar but wasn't called a GST, and where the money ended up going was perhaps a little different. But the thing that was happening through 88, when the GST was introduced in Parliament, the main topic of conversation wasn't the GST, it was the free trade bill.
Right.
That's what had all the attention. And this did kind of slip under the radar. There were some who were upset about it. It was introduced by the Mulroney government. I I think Mike Wilson was the finance minister mm-hmm. at the time. And the Liberals under John Turner were so focused on free trade, they didn't really get into the debate around the GST, from what I recall. Because I can remember, you know, Turner and I had a really fascinating relationship over 20, 30 years. I liked the guy a lot. I learned a lot from him. But I can remember in 88, they tried to dump him in the middle of the campaign, and I broke that story, and it was very controversial. But it never affected our relationship. And I can remember after the campaign, because he made a comeback in the debate in 88, it looked like he was going to lose almost every seat the Liberals had, and he ended up winning 80, which was double what he'd won in 84 against Mulroney. But anyway, I can remember saying to him at lunch afterwards, why didn't you push the GST? You needed a second front. You'd made the case on the free trade. You'd basically won that debate and scared the hell out of the Conservatives and Mulroney. And if you'd open up a second front on GST, it was a natural. And he said, just thought I had to just keep going after free trade. So it was sitting there as an issue, and then it kind of, people, you know, were mad about it, but they accepted it. And then Harper was smart enough to realize, if I promise to drop the rate, that's going to be a winner for me. And it was in the 2006 election. It's one of those arguments about politics mm-hmm. that the simpler you make the promise, the more impact it can have. You remember Doug Ford with Bucket Beer and Harper with I'll drop the GST rate, 1 point or 2 points. And people understand that. Like, it means, you know,
yes.
They don't need a degree in climatology to understand the carbon tax mm-hmm. issue, right? So that's the little right. I recall about that time, that it kind of slipped under the radar. It wasn't the issue that it could have been, perhaps should have been, and might have made a difference in that campaign, the 88 campaign. It came in to effect January 1st, 89. So people weren't actually dealing with it in the campaign, like consumers. They didn't have to worry about it. It was something off in the distance. But then when the distance right. arrived, they got it, you know, right between the eyes.
Yeah, I was doing a little bit of reading up on it because this was, at the time, I would have been 12, so I wasn't covering or even thinking about, you know, the business news at the time. So I had to read up on this history a little bit. And it seemed like it was quite a contentious thing behind the scenes because it was originally proposed as a 9% tax. And it was proposed by the Mulroney government. And it ended up that the Liberal-controlled Senate refused to pass it. And then I think they ended up filibustering until I think Mulroney brought in 8 more senators to get the thing passed. It just seems like what a fascinating thing that happens behind the scenes. And like you said, most people probably didn't sort of tune into that as much because the talk of the town was all free trade agreement.
Yeah.
Which was a huge undertaking.
Certainly through that 88 election, that was what the talk was about. After the election, as you got closer to implementation date on GST and it needed royal assent, then you saw all that activity in the Senate, and it was right. quite something to watch.
Now, speaking of elections, the election night coverage, is that like the Super Bowl for a news broadcaster?
I think it is. I've always, you know, I grew up, you know, I can remember sitting there. This is long before I ever thought I'd end up in journalism, but I can remember, you know, watching 58, the election, the deep sweep of 58, watching the limited television coverage that existed then through elections in 63 and 65 and 68, through the 60s, the heavily dominated election schedule during those years. And it was the big deal. It was the broadcast that defined people, defined networks, and they would throw everything at it. they're big budget nights because there's a lot involved in trying to cover an election night, and you know, you're taking a huge gamble on how well your computers and your graphics presentation and all that are going to work. Enormous pressure over the executive producers who were involved in those. You mentioned Laura earlier as the person who found you. She's the executive producer of CBC's election coverage for the last couple of elections, and including whatever is going to happen this year.
The conversation with Peter Mansbridge continues in just a moment. Now, as regular listeners know, during the mid-show segment, I work my way through all the listener comments. I am sorely behind, and I won't be able to give everyone a shout-out, as this may be the last episode for the show. But I just wanted to thank you all for spending your time with me over these 100 episodes. It means a lot to me. Now, I may relaunch the show again after a short break, but right now, I have just a few too many projects on the go. Many of those are actually wrapping up by the end of 2021, but I may enjoy some downtime for a bit and then sit down to give a think about what I want to do with the podcast and any future content creation. Now, stay subscribed to the podcast if you are subscribed, and if I do relaunch it, you'll be the first to know. And if I don't relaunch it, well, you're not going to notice anything. Before I get back to the interview with Peter, I should point out that his laptop died at this point in the interview, and he switched to a different computer which had a different microphone. So the audio quality changes a bit, but you know, with a voice like his, he'd sound good talking into a tin can with a string. And I don't know about you, but I really miss hearing his voice on a regular basis. But you know what? There's a solution for that. You can subscribe to his podcast, The Bridge. And now, back to the conversation with Peter Mansbridge.
I just think it's the most important night of any broadcaster's new schedule is the election. You define yourself as a network. The people who are in the front row of your news coverage, it defines them. Careers are made or broken on election nights. And, you know, it's more than just people, it's resources. And if the networks don't put behind their people the kind of resources they need for an election night, in other words, money, it can damage you. And I fear at times that some of the networks don't, you know, have forgotten that or think that we've passed that's a sort of, you know, a part of our past as opposed to a part of our present or future. I think the most important night in a cycle is an election night. It's when democracy plays its role in our society. And the decision of the people is paramount, and we should be there to help guide it through to the finish line in terms of coverage.
And I know that, it's been a few years since you anchored, the news, let alone the election. And in the last federal election in Canada, you came as a special contributor. What was it like being not the anchor that night?
Well, it's hard to get used to that role. It's also liberating in a sense because they wanted me there as an analyst. And Bob Ray and I were sitting together and people were said it looked like those two old guy Muppets in the theater. but it was fun because, I could draw on certain experiences I had to explain what I thought about the way things were unfolding. So I enjoyed that, but obviously it wasn't the same as the anchoring. Rosie Barton did a terrific job as anchor that night, and time moves on, and I understand and accept that.
And do you feel that you will come back with in an analyst role? Do you feel that you have, like you said, you're much more liberated in what you can say? Do you feel like there is a significant change versus being the anchor?
Sure. I mean, you're everybody's anchor when you're the anchor. That's what it's supposed to be, and say on an election night, any party
any supporter of any party should feel comfortable with you in that role, in terms of that you're not one-sided or biased. You're just telling the story. As an analyst, you can show a little more kind of flair on what you think about certain things. And I've enjoyed doing that with the podcast. I still hold back, a fair amount, but I have moved on from my anchor position in terms of of what I end up saying and doing.
Now, speaking of your podcast, there is, I don't think it's every day, but you have a Smoke and Mirrors edition of the podcast. Is that correct? Can you explain what that is?
Well, what we're trying to do is separate the smoke and mirrors from the truth, right? And so every Wednesday and through the summer, that's the only one I'm doing. I'm doing one day a week until the elections call. And so we do Smoke, Mirrors, and the Truth with Bruce Anderson, who's a longtime friend of mine, a pollster. He's worked for all the parties at one time or another, especially the conservatives and the liberals. So he has a wealth of experience. And we tried to, to talk in that general sense of, separating what's true from what's just, they're trying to pull the wool over your eyes on some things. And so we try to explain that, and we have a lot of fun doing it.
Well, it's so enjoyable to listen to the two of you banter and talk about things, because there's such a wealth of experience between the both of you. And like you said, Bruce's experience being a pollster and working for both sides, of the aisle, and then your experience with, 5 decades of coverage, phenomenal. So for anyone who's listening, I really highly recommend Peter's podcast. Okay, the last thing I have to ask you about is Trump. and that is only because, as of late, he just made an appearance, and it looks like he is looking to build support for getting the party's nomination for the next election. And I think some people thought, no, Trump's done now. But does he ever go away? Does his influence in politics ever change at this point?
I've been a believer all along that he will go away, that the last person the Republicans really want is Donald Trump again. Now you run that up against the fact that, there are a lot of people who still believe in anything he says, no matter how bizarre or unhinged it may sound. And those are the people who are sick and tired of what they perceive as the normal, kind of BS that's come out of Washington for decades. And they believe in conspiracy theories and a lot of other things because they've been put in the position of having to believe them because they feel they haven't been served in any reasonable way in the past. Now, I think what surprised us is that there are more of those people than we ever thought there were. I mean, that the guy could get whatever it was, 70 million votes in the last election, considerably less than Biden, but still a hell of a lot of votes, does tell you something. Now, I think the Republicans are going to go through hoops to try and figure out a way that he isn't there. Representative, I guess if they're hoping anything is that he ends up in jail before election, or that he ends up ruined or broke as a result of the various actions that are being taken against his companies. But I don't know. I've given up making predictions. I never thought he could win the nomination, let alone the presidency in 2016. I can remember being at his inauguration, and I was in Washington, and when I covered that, and within 24 hours, he was lying about the crowd size, all the people he sent out. I thought, this is crazy. Crowd size, who cares? But if this guy's president of the United States, if this is an indication of what it's going to be like, and I tweeted I flew out of Washington on a 6 a.m. flight on the Sunday morning. He was inaugurated on the Friday. I flew out on the 6 a.m. on the Sunday morning, and I wrote something like, I've never felt so unsettled as I pass over the White House. You know, when a president and his people lie, and I use the L word, lie, it crumbles an important pillar of democracy. And I took so much heat on that by calling it a lie.
Right.
Including from the CBC.
Really?
You're not supposed to say anything, Peter. Certainly not that. And I just said, you know what? I'm sorry. This is outrageous. Anyway, it was 6 months or a year before the mainstream media in the States started using the L word. Mm-hmm. They, covered it up, and they felt they couldn't say lie. Now it's like lying is in every sentence attributed to anything about Trump. But we saw it right from the beginning, and quite frankly, we saw it throughout the guy's career. You talk to more business people than I do, but I've talked to a number of business people in Toronto who were involved at different levels with Trump on projects that he was doing in Canada. And they all backed away from it, said there's nothing about this guy I can trust. And I don't want anything to do with him.
Yeah.
And this was... this is based on events before he ran for the presidency. And I can remember hearing those stories early on and thinking, man, can that possibly be true? And if it's true, why hasn't anybody in the States figured this out yet? Listen, I'll tell you one thing about Trump. He always used to say, if I lose or if I'm gone, you guys in the media are going to miss me. He was right.
Yeah.
He was right. Yeah. They miss him. And they're finding it awfully hard to do just your basic, normal, legitimate stories about government.
Right.
without that clown show going on in the White House.
Right.
So they miss him. They certainly miss him.
I'll tell you, we miss you anchoring the news. I certainly do. But I know that people can get their hit of Peter Mansbridge on his podcast. At the end of every episode on this podcast, everyone gets a commercial. unabashedly promote anything that you want. We talked about your book and your podcast, but feel free to talk about those again or anything else that you want to promote. The floor is yours.
Well, I would promote information, real, hard, true information. And I would try to encourage people to demand it of their information sources, make them accountable, call for more transparency on the part of all journalistic operations in terms of the way they're doing their jobs and the decisions they make. On a personal note, obviously, I would like people to listen to The Bridge when they're finished listening to Preet's podcast, and you can find that on any podcast platform or on Sirius XM channel 167 Canada Talks. They bought the rights to the podcast, so it's up on their normal satellite radio service before it is then pushed out as a podcast, the same program. I had a very successful book last year, In Extraordinary Canadians, that I wrote with my friend Mark Bilgich, which reached number one as a national bestseller. And this fall, October, as Preet mentioned, I'm coming out with my new book called Off the Record, which is more personal. And I think I think if you're interested in the kind of behind the scenes stories about news, you'll get a lot of them in here. Plus my own thoughts about journalism in general and where we are today in that profession. And also my thoughts about Canada and the challenges we still face, because if anything, the last few months have reminded us that we're not there yet. We're a great country. There's a lot of good about it, but we're not where we want to be yet. And we need help and a push to get there. So that's my uh, That's my free promo.
Well, Peter, it's been an absolute honor for me to have you on this podcast. I look forward to sharing some stories off the record over a tipple, maybe some whiskey at your place in Scotland, I think it is, right?
You got it.
So I'm going to be across the pond as well for the next couple of years. So hopefully we can, share a few drinks. But thank you again so much. Highlight of my career was being on the Bottom Line panel for 8 years and meeting and working with you.
That's very kind of you, Preet. And you know I enjoyed doing those, and you were always a mainstay on it. So good luck in the challenges ahead, and I'll be listening.
Well, that is it for Mostly Money. I would love to stay in touch, though. You can visit my website, preetbanerjee.com, and subscribe to my email newsletter. I haven't published content there for a while, but while the podcast might be ending, the website will be relaunching in 2022, maybe a little bit earlier, as I do feel the urge to start blogging again. Maybe. I'll have to think about that. In any case, I will continue to create more financial content in different media at the very least. So if that is of interest, please do sign up. And when I do have stuff to share, you will be the first to know. Until then, it's been an honor and a privilege.